Okay. I was all by myself.
Blog Talk Radio.
Jeff, Karen, Kat, are you ready for this
you
one?
Go.
We say and hope we want, give it to you non-stop. Any place, any time, not afraid to speak our mind. That's just how every road we never gonna go. Unstoppable, original, uncensored radio.
It is Uncensored Radio, and this is No Rules, Just Mics. I am your host, Christian. I am glad to be here with my good friends and co-hosts, Topher and Person. And we are here for the No Rules Radio Show, bringing you the latest and sometimes controversial topics that you want to know. And as I mentioned before, we are your hosts. Let's check in with each of them. Topher, how you doing, buddy? I know you're a little under the weather today.
Yeah, I've been under the weather for the last couple of days, but I am on the upswing, and I'm so glad to be back on the air. I want to apologize about the technical difficulties that we had. Apparently, we've been having it all last week, but hopefully those have been all ironed out, and we're coming to you with a great show.
Absolutely. It was. We do apologize, like Topher said. Rough go of it last week. I think we got about half an hour in total out of our normal hour. I know we were bummed out, and I'm sure folks that were listening in were too, but we appreciate you guys sticking with us, and we're ready to do it up big this week to make up for it. And doing it up big with Topher and I, of course, is Mr. Chris Merson. How are you doing today, bud?
I'm doing fantastic. I had an unexpected day at work today, so I went in, put in my 9 hours like I normally do, came home, and excited to be on the show.
Ugh. Getting called into work or unexpected work is definitely the worst, but we're glad that you didn't have to work too much longer and you got home in time for the show. We got all sorts of good stuff that we can talk about tonight. A lot been going on in the news, a lot of interesting things as well. First up, I'm going to do the Holy City Center rundown for the weekend for all you Charleston listeners. For those of you new to the show, two out of the three of us currently live in Charleston, and the one who does not, Mr. Burson, did live in Charleston for a few years. So we have a lot of listeners and friends who tune in, and we just like to break down what's going on in the city, especially since I have a website dedicated to such activities, holycitycenter.com. You can check it out any point. This weekend, we got Charleston Restaurant Week, of course, that is wrapping up. All sorts of good deals going on at area restaurants, everything from your normal run-of-the-mill places to some of the higher-end 4- and 5-star joints downtown, participating in a price-fixed menu. I know I'm not using the appropriate term, but just so we can be clear, they do have menus with fixed prices just to let people come in the doors and check out some food that they would not normally be able to. Places like the famous Husk by Chef Sean Brock, McCrady's, et cetera, et cetera. So that's completing this weekend, so be sure to get to those restaurants before the weekend is out. There's also, your normal activities, as far as live music and such, and you can check all that out on the website. But another big one is the sea turtle release. We have an aquarium here in Charleston. They do a fantastic job year in and year out of putting on great displays and parties and charity events. And teaching, school children and adults for that matter, all about the sea life, especially around the Charleston area. And one of the things they have is a sea turtle rescue program. They have a sea turtle hospital where they rehabilitate turtles that are found with various diseases or injuries and such. And Saturday at 10 a.m. at the Isle of Palms County Park, you can witness three of such turtles being released back into the ocean. I've gone to a couple of these releases. It's always an extremely unique and fun event. It's completely free, save for whatever parking you may have to pay for. But it's really cool to see people lined up on the beach and watch usually a pretty large creature make its way back into the ocean after being, brought back to health. It's a pretty cool thing to witness, a great opportunity for some good pictures as well. Highly recommend it, 10 a.m. on Saturday. It is free. An hour later, you can just head not too far away in James Island. There's a benefit for ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease at Brick House Kitchen. A bunch of bands will be playing, food and such. Also should be a good event on Saturday. And the last big event, also on Saturday, actor Gary Sinise is in town. He's doing a charity event for soldiers specifically soldiers that are back here and need some help, veterans of war who are injured and such. You may remember Forrest Gump, of course, the classic movie where Gary Sinise played Lieutenant Dan, and that's where the charity kind of began. He will have his Lieutenant Dan Band, as it's called, here performing at Haygood Stadium downtown at the Citadel. Like I said, it should be a great way to raise money for veterans, and also should be fun to see. So that's what's going on here in Charleston. You can catch it all every single day, holycitycenter.com. So a lot of fun events going on. Hopefully we'll make it out to a few, and Burson, you can live vicariously through us as we do it.
Well, I was going to ask if you had a chance to enjoy Restaurant Week in Charleston at all yet.
Well, the one fun thing I was able to do, it's been pretty low-key around these parts, but, yeah, the girlfriend and I did go to dinner at the South End Brewery on East Bay Street. We'd actually never eaten there. We've been inside and had drinks before, but never had eaten there. Surprisingly, not bad. I've heard mixed results about the place, but had some good food. Pimento cheese on fried green tomatoes, which I just tried because it's restaurant week. You can try things you normally wouldn't have. And it was actually really, really good. And then we all, you know, we got some other things as well, some brisket, which was delicious, and, you know, dessert with some apple, you know, like apple crumb with ice cream, or apple crisp, I should say, with ice cream. So we did get to do that, which was fun. Friends of ours went to Husk, which is a very famous and popular restaurant here. I'm a little jealous that we didn't make the trip there. But after the show, or I'm sorry, after the dinner, the girlfriend and I went to a concert. We saw the Airborne Toxic event, which is a rock band who their best known song is probably Sometime Around Midnight. Good show. We had a good time. But other than that, been pretty quiet around these parts. You guys been doing anything fun out in your areas of town?
Well, this past weekend back in good old Illinois, my niece had her 2-year-old birthday party. So I headed up to Chicago to spend time with family, which was one thing that I could not do living in Charleston. I couldn't just make a day trip of it and go hang out with my family. So that was one of the main reasons of moving back to the central Illinois area, so that way I could certainly spend time with family. And those are one of the things that I promised myself that I would certainly do for my brother and his kid, and it's his first child. So being the uncle that spoils the niece, that's my role, and I will stick to it.
Absolutely. I'm in the same boat as you, whereas, you know, I love my hometown. I'm proud of where I'm from, which is up in Connecticut, for those who don't know. Moved here and love it here. Love everything about Charleston, but absolutely miss my family and my brother. They've had their first kid, another on the way. You know, it sucks missing out on that. And I know it's a trade-off. Either you live in a place that, not that Chicago, the city itself isn't fun and lots of cool things to do, but between the weather and just some of the things Charleston has to offer, for me, it's a much more fun and vibrant place than anywhere in Connecticut. So I definitely miss, you know, my family, not much else about the state. So if I was to ever go home, I'd be in the same boat as you, which is, you know, I'd be really happy to see my family and spoil my nephew and all that good stuff. So it sounds pretty good. Topher, I know you're on. Go ahead.
I would say, if you have to compare Charleston and Chicago, Charleston is going to win every single time.
Yeah, I mean, I've only been to Chicago once for about 3 days, if you don't count the times I flew into O'Hare a million times and never stepped foot outside. But only once have I actually gone outside, and it was summer, so it was nice. I liked it. There were some cool things. You know, I just didn't want to make a rash judgment based on 3 days, but I assumed Charleston's probably going to beat most places, especially in the north, save for maybe New York City, maybe a Boston, just because they're so huge and there is so much to do in those places. But I didn't want to bash your city without, you know, without having
no, that's
good
fine.
Reason.
Go ahead.
Hey, Chicago's got some delicious deep dish pizza, and the Chicago style hot dog is still my favorite type of hot dog there is out there.
But it does not compare to anything like the seafood that you can get in the Charleston area.
Oh, God.
Not at all.
No, of course not. Or any of the fried food, for that matter. Yeah, no.
Well,
Southern food is definitely the best. But, you know, every region has its own its own things it's known for and is special just because it's there. But Topher, I know you were sick. I don't know how long you've been sick, but have you done anything fun around the area lately?
No, I really started getting sick on Monday. Monday I had, you know, that quintessential tickle in the throat, that cough clearing thing that people do. It's like, I have a tickle in my throat, which turned into really, really, really bad sore throat, and then everything else came on. So it's been about 4 days, but I'm on the downswing of that, which is really good because it was awful. I normally don't take any time off of work because I'm sick. I just don't. But I literally was forced out of my office on Tuesday, and they said, don't come back tomorrow. So I didn't go to work yesterday, which was good because I slept most of the day, which I think that's what my body needed. But I'm on the upswing, which is really, really good.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. If you're going to miss work, it's always good to go in and then be told to go home. So that way it's out of your hands. You don't have to feel guilty. I don't know if you're like me. No, I know, but it's worse. Like, well, even when I'm sick, I'm like, I should not be at work. And I call out and I'm legitimately sick. I always feel guilty. Like, oh, I wish I was there. Oh, I'm leaving them shorthanded. Even though you shouldn't feel guilty, I do. But it was never really an issue when I showed up and I was visibly sick and people were like, yeah, you should go home. You know, it made it a little bit easier.
For sure. Yeah, that's kind of how I feel. If I at least made the effort to go into work and I'm legitimately sick and if they send me home, then that's one thing. But if I call out, I get nervous. I get like anxiety attacks and that having to call my boss and say, hey, I'm really not feeling good. I'm not coming in today because there's always this. And, you know, my boss, I have an awesome boss. She's so cool. She's probably the best boss that I've ever had. And I've been working since I was 15 years old. She's the best boss. And I know that there's a small percentage, I think, in every boss when you hear an employee call out, even though I'm a supervisor, even when you hear an employee call out, there's a little percentage that they think, is he really sick or is he just calling because he wants to just have a day off?
Right.
I've never,
ever
been that person. I lie.
Yeah.
I've been that person a couple of times, but not when I'm sick. I'm really sick, and I don't like to call out. But I'd rather get dressed, drive all the way to Mount Pleasant from Somerville, and then for them to say, all right, you're sick, you just got to go. I feel better knowing
exactly,
that I'm physically sick, and that way there's none of this, oh, maybe he's faking it, or maybe he's really not sick. I don't like
right.
that.
Right, he's going
that,
to the beach.
That bothers me.
He's going to the beach today. It's a personal day, yeah.
Right. But this
weekend, well, you know,
I have a very good friend who I've known probably longer than I've known anybody in Charleston. I've known him since we were both 17. His name is Matt. He lives in Colorado. I met him on the LGBT chat room back when AOL was a thing. It was a big gay support chat room, and we became fast friends, and I've met him a couple of times in Colorado, but this is his first time that he's coming here with his partner. So Matthew and I are playing host to two Charleston newbies. They've never been to Charleston before, so we're really kind of rolling out the red carpet for them, so to speak. We have some surprises up our sleeve, but I don't know who's listening, so I'm not going to give any details away, but I'm really, really excited. I'm really excited. So hopefully I can kick whatever this is tonight and be ready and ready to go to pick him up at the airport tomorrow. So I'll have to let everybody know.
Nice.
And of course, I have a camera phone, so I'm going to be taking a lot of pictures and I'm going to post them all over Facebook and our Noel's Facebook page. So tune in.
Awesome, awesome. Always fun to have, you know, newbies, or even after they've been here once or twice. It's still a lot of fun to show people around the city and see the reactions to certain parts of it, you know, downtown areas like the Battery and some of the big mansions and such. And just, I don't know, it's always fun to introduce some of the things that you love about the city. And sometimes you end up discovering something new. So I'm sure you'll have a blast. But I wanted to go back to, you know, you're talking about work and calling out sick. And although you work in the medical field, and I do as well, much different. I do much different work than you do. You actually are hands-on with patients. But I also worked in a customer service field with Mr. Burson not too long ago. So we all deal with customers or have dealt with customers in some capacity, whether they're patients or, you know, direct retail customers. And I've had both worlds where I have learned that maybe it's not just retail where customers can get a little cranky. Pretty much anything involving people that need a service, especially a service that involves them paying money, they're going to be cranky and there's going to be problems. And on the reverse, companies and hospitals and whatever else are going to screw up and there's going to be problems. So with that said, I came across an article this week, and This is the one Burson came across this week. And definitely shared it with me because we had been down in the, well, I shouldn't say trenches because it's not quite like warfare, but I couldn't think of a better term at the moment. But we were down in those retail trenches dealing with customers and seeing both sides where we saw the side of the company sometimes. We also understood the customer side. Topher, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's a Huffington Post article written by Matt Walsh. And the title is Maybe You Get Bad Customer Service Because You're a Bad Customer. And I was immediately, I knew I was going to love the article before I even read it. since you're the one who passed it along, why don't you kind of give those, we're going to put the link up in the chat room for you guys to check out later, but you can give a quick synopsis here and let us know what you think.
Absolutely, yeah. I came across the article, and it was actually a friend of mine that posted it on Facebook, and I'm not going to throw her under the bus on who it was, but I clicked on it just out of curiosity, just from the title itself, and it really hit home because working in retail for my entire life, I really, really enjoyed this article. And the article written by Matt Walsh is, it's all from his perspective of an interaction that he had at a fast food place. And to kind of give you a summary for those who haven't read it, he's standing in line, and this lady comes into this fast food place and basically slams this food down on the countertop and just screams out, "No ketchup, I said no ketchup." And she's obviously very, very distraught at the order that was not completed to her satisfaction. The customer then goes on to say, "What's wrong with you people? I just sat in the drive-thru for, I don't know, it was like 7, 8, 9 minutes or whatever it was, and now I've got to come in here because you guys can't make my order correctly. I ordered it with no ketchup, but of course she always gets ketchup on this burger. And she, for the no rules, I'm going to claim earmuffs for those that are underage listening, for all of you. She says this happens every fucking time that she goes into the store. So Matt Walsh decided that he was going to kind of give his own rebuttal in form of an article rather than actually confronting this lady. And he points out that there are many fast food places within this 2-mile radius of where she always gets this order messed up. And it kind of put it into perspective that this lady was always constantly going back to this fast food place, but she was constantly getting this order wrong, and it was constantly the store's fault or the associate's fault or whoever was making her food. It was no fault other than, not her own fault. It was somebody else. She wanted to point the finger. And in his article, he goes on to say that he replays this scenario back in his head, and he called it the tragic ketchup calamity because – every single time this lady would go in, she would get this order wrong. And from his point of view, maybe it wasn't necessarily the restaurant or the associate's fault. Maybe she truly forgot to ask for ketchup. Maybe she was in such a hurry and such a busy rush that maybe she just forgot to say that. But the customer was not having anything to do with it because and anyone that works in retail, you will hear them say, "The customer is always right. No matter what, the customer is always right." Even if the customer may have lied to you and said that they wanted extra ketchup, and they come back in and they say, "No, I said no ketchup," we have to take it as though the customer is always right. So it the title is maybe you get bad customer service because you're truly just a bad customer coming in yelling and screaming, and people are unwilling to really help you out because it may be actually you are the one that's at fault in this scenario. But those people in retail know we can't exactly point the finger back at them and say, no, because you told me you wanted extra ketchup or you didn't tell me. It's always the customer that's right. So I'll pose this question to you, Christian, and to you, Topher. I know I've worked in retail for a long time, and somebody who comes in who's extremely angry or extremely upset and they're yelling and screaming, me personally, I'm less apt to help them out with whatever their end result is, whatever they want to have happen. But if I've got somebody that comes in and says, hey, I don't know if I ordered this wrong. I don't know if somebody misheard me. Can you help me understand? Or is there any way this can be fixed? Or what can we do about this? And they're polite and level-headed and not screaming and yelling using profanity. I'm apt to help them out 100 times over and bend over backwards for that individual versus somebody coming and yelling and screaming. Would you agree, disagree? What do you guys think on it?
Well, for me, I'm similar because a lot of times when people would come in yelling and screaming, I would kind of shut down and I would just be like, nope. And sometimes that wasn't, admittedly, that wasn't the best solution because sometimes I had every right to be mad and sometimes people are going to raise their voice and that's fine. Sometimes I took it personally, but in reality, I tried to kind of gauge their anger. You know, are they being completely unreasonable? Like, what are they requesting, number one? You know, is it something that is my fault or the company's fault? And I'm the company, so I have to take that. If they're being unreasonable, forget it. I'm way less likely to help out. But if they have a legitimate case and they're not doing something way over the top, like swearing or belittling me or other employees or anything like that, you know, I would still possibly help out as much as I could. You know, it all depends. But the thing that I learned is, and I've learned now in my second career here, is that no matter what the service is, there's going to be someone pissed. And, you know, you just never know what it's going to be about. You never know if it's legitimate. You don't know what's going to set people off. You don't know what's going on in their lives. But, yes, I am more likely to help someone who's being calm, reasonable. But that's not to say that if someone raises their voice or starts to get a little agitated, that they won't get the help they deserve. Because I've seen the company or other employees or even myself screw up, do something wrong. And I deserve to be yelled at or scolded or, you know, have people mad at me or whatever. You try not to take it personally, but it's tough. And you try to help people out who aren't going over that line. And I think for me, it also has made me a better customer almost to a fault sometimes, where even when someone's screwed up an order, say, at a fast food restaurant or a bartender is just, like, ignoring me at the bar and, you know, is giving me crappy service, whatever it may be, I'm more likely to just let it go. And sometimes that's the right thing to do, and other times I've had my girlfriend or friends be like, what are you doing? Just say this. You know, you should be mad. You should call them. You should demand this. You should, you know, whatever. Because I'm like, no, I don't want to be that customer because I've seen so many people just fly off the handle for no reason. I know that's not what you were asking, but I just, you know, I was wondering the same thing about you guys and Topher after you mentioned what kind of how you deal with people that are upset. I was just interested for you both, you know, has that changed you as a customer? But Topher, first versus question, you know, are you like us? Do you, you know, when people are yelling and screaming, just kind of shut down and let you help them? Or does it depend?
Okay, so it's a twofold question. Before I started working at this current job, the answer is yes. If you're an asshole to me, I'm less likely to give you even adequate customer service. If you come in and you're demanding and you're just uncooperative and you're not listening and you're throwing profanities, I really shut down because I don't feel it's necessary. You're not my parents. You have no right to talk to me that way. I'm an adult. You need to treat me like one. And I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. I try to let them vent. I don't say a word. I just let them, they say whatever they have to say. And then I say, well, it sounds like you're really, really upset about this. What can I do to help? and then usually changes the tone, because now they've got it out. I know they're mad. They know that I know that they're mad. And now the words out of my mouth, how can I help you? It's no longer them being mad at me. It's now they think that they feel like I'm on their side and I want to help them. And it really changes the dynamics of how that interaction occurs. So my current job, I really, really hone in on that. I have to hone in on that just because of the caliber of patients that I have and what I do. I really have to be patient with my quote-unquote customers or patients, and I have to learn to put any kind of personal issues that I have aside, because they're not mad at me per se, and if they are, then, you know, I own up to it. But for a long time before I started doing this, yeah, you got very little out of me, if anything at all. And 9 times out of 10, I say, you know what, I can't help you. So how about you go down there, you yell at that person, because I can't help you, because you're not giving me anything to work with.
And, you know, it's tough, too, because you brought up something where someone's mad at whether it's the company or the business or another coworker. It's really hard because you don't want to throw a coworker, and sometimes you don't want to throw the company under the bus either. So it's tough to be like, yeah, they screwed up, but let me do it. I'm better. You know, you got to find that nice balance, you know, of being like, I understand you're frustrated. What can I do for you without really bringing up the past? You know, it's a tough balance, but that's a whole other issue in and of itself. But, yeah, I think, I don't know about person, but I was the same way as you. Like, when I first started, I was way more likely to just be like, screw it, I'm not helping you, like, immediately at the drop of a hat. And you kind of learn that that's not always the best way to go, and you kind of learn from it and you adapt. But the bottom line is, no matter how you react, there's always going to be people like that. And it's embarrassing sometimes to, you know, to witness these things or, you know, see how the other people act. It's crazy. And I've been in situations where I feel bad for, like, their kids, if, you know, some parents going off, wives where husbands were going crazy and vice versa. It's embarrassing and it's sad to see sometimes, even if it's legitimate, you know, just the extremes that some people will go. But for both you guys, Burson, first, I guess, because you haven't heard from me in a little bit, has this changed you as a customer?
Well, that's a difficult question, because I was never, even younger, when somebody messed up something or they got something wrong, I wasn't the guy to throw a fit and start yelling and screaming and, you know, cursing. I wasn't ever that person. But I will say, being in retail and the specific retail that I'm in, this high demand, high stress, fast paced, ever changing industry, it's made me realize even more that it may not be that person that I'm talking to's fault. They might not have had anything to do with it. And if I yell and scream at them, they may just turn, they may be the new person on the block. They may be only there for, you know, a month or 2 months. I don't know the backstory behind it. And they may shut down.
Right.
They may be less apt to help me. Whereas if I go in and say, hey, this was broken, this, you know, I don't know how it got this way, did I do something wrong, what can be done, or, hey, you messed up my order, you know, I asked for French fries and the onion rings, you know, is there any way maybe I can get the onion rings instead, or French fries instead, but I don't know if I changed, but it certainly helped me realize more of the employee side rather than the customer is always right side.
Right. I'm kind of with you. I've never been overly aggressive when it comes to being a customer. I'd like to say that, but I know that I've had my moments where I've been just an asshole on the phone. But that's not because it was the first time that I had to make a phone call, and it's because of my cable company. Everybody knows, you know, what kind of cable is in Charleston. It's the big one where you get frustrated because you call and you ask them a question and you want help, and then they say they're going to help you, but then that doesn't happen. So you call a couple of days later and you're a little, you know, perturbed, and you're saying, yeah, I called a couple of days ago and you guys said you guys were going to fix this, and, you know, nothing came of it. You know, what's the status on it? oh, we'll get somebody right after. I mean, you know, somebody will come out and they'll do whatever they have to do. And when they leave, of course, it's not working. So now I have to make another phone call. And it's not like, you know, you dial the number and it's like, thank you for calling this cable company. How may I help you? It's, this is you need a hold, or the volume levels are high. And then you just get really pissed off. So I'm not, I am making excuses for the fact that, you know, I can be a pain in the ass sometimes with customer service. But in general, like in face-to-face, I really, really try to take the more passive route just because I don't know what that person on the other side of that counter has gone through, what they're capable of, you know, what their day is like, what their home, I don't know. So I kind of approach it gingerly and then just kind of fill it out from there. But I'm not afraid to stand up for myself as a customer. I'm not going to let them walk all over me either. I think there's a fine line with that.
Absolutely. I think you guys made some great points. And, you know, if anybody has any opinions on it that's listening, I know we posted the number in the chat room, but feel free to dial us in for those who are in the chat or just listening. We'll be happy to hear any stories, whether you're on one side or the other, whether you're a customer or, you know, you're someone who's lost it and you thought you were, you know, it was the right thing to do, or maybe you got such bad customer service they almost left you with no, you know, no choice. Even though we might change topics, if you want to go back to a topic, just let us know. And, you know, I think we've kind of gotten the point there. And another topic I thought was pretty interesting, Topher, you actually found this article and sent it off to me and Burson. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it came from CNN. And it has to do with text messaging while driving. Now, Topher, when you sent it to me, I was like, why is Topher sending this to me? This is boring. We've had this text message conversation before. People shouldn't text and drive. I mean, duh, what can we really talk about? But I looked at the article anyway, and I'm glad I did because the headline didn't make it clear. But in reading the article, it's a little bit different than drivers in the car texting and driving. Topher, tell us a little bit about the article.
So, you know, the article was on CNN, and I thought it was a really good article. It's basically New Jersey is essentially you can be sued for texting someone who you know is driving a car, which how are you supposed to know that all the time? There's all these little idiosyncrasies, but New Jersey is actually wanting to pass a law that you can actually get sued if you text somebody while they're driving and there is an incident, it could essentially be your fault. Which I want to know from you guys, do you feel like that's fair? Do you feel that's kind of an invasion in privacy with, you know, the state and government, just like everything else that's been going on? You know, there's a lot of that going on. Do you feel like that's almost intrusive, or do you feel like they're taking this whole texting and driving one step too far? What are your thoughts?
Well, if I can go first, I absolutely agree with it. The concept behind is that the person who is driving the car tells the other person, hey, I'm driving, or I'm on my way, or somehow relays back to that person that they are driving. The other person who is not driving continues to text back, and they have a conversation back and forth. The article really doesn't point out too clearly, but I think I'm on the right path here, that they actually had a lawsuit against the driver for texting while driving, and then they had a lawsuit against the other person who knowingly
right.
text messaged the other individual while driving. So
yeah.
I would see it on the same scale as this is an extreme, and don't take this too seriously, but like an accomplice to murder, someone who doesn't actually pull the trigger, but somebody who aided in that act. So I'm 100% for it. And if that keeps texting while driving down because if I know somebody's driving and they're not a safe driver to begin with, and they tell me they're driving, and then I know that I can be sued because I am text messaging if they cause an accident, you're darn right I'm going to not text message. And if that means that saves individuals from accidents, injury, death, absolutely. I'm 100% on board.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I don't text while I drive. If the phone goes off and I just ignore it. I usually have my music on. So I actually get pissed off when I hear that a text message because you're interrupting my phone, damn it. But I mean, I think you know, if we're going to play devil's advocate, regardless of if you're sending somebody a text message and they're driving, the person needs to have some kind of common sense and say, I'm not that great of a driver, or I know I shouldn't be texting and driving. It can wait, you know, the whole it can wait thing. You really, you as a driver, make that decision. It's not for me to get in trouble because you don't know how to not answer your text messages while you're driving. So I think you can kind of play both sides. What are your thoughts, Christian?
I think it's a really interesting conversation, and I was, you know, I said that to you guys before too. I don't want to repeat some of the things you guys said, so I'll try to brush over them. But like I said, it's an interesting argument because this isn't the person in the car who clearly is, you know, doing something dangerous while they're driving. It's somebody on the other end. And it's interesting because it's a law that says if you know the other person's in the car, there, you know, you can be liable. And I understand what Burson's saying, where it might seem extreme, but if that person got in an accident because you texted them and they were looking at that text and they killed someone, you're almost like an accessory to murder. And, you know, again, it seems kind of extreme. And I haven't really made a decision yet, so I'm kind of talking it out as I'm going about how I feel about this. I think it'll be fairly difficult to prove, you know, intent, or not intent, I guess the word is, prove that the person on the other end knew that that person was driving. Now, again, Burson said there could be something in the text messages like, hey, I'm driving, I'll be there soon, or, you know, maybe even the texter says, hey, I'm sure you're driving right now, but blah, 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 blah. But really,
right.
How much blame can you put on that person? Because, number one, they're not actually in the car with that person. They have no idea if that person is going to check that at a stoplight or if that person's already at their destination. You have no way of knowing. Or if that person's lying. That person be like, hey, I'm in the car, I'll talk to you later, and they're just sitting at home because they're just trying to ignore text. You know, how
right.
is it that person's responsibility to know for sure? And I guess what Burson said is a good point, though. If there's a law on the books and people are aware of it, it might be enough for people to just stop texting or not do it. You know, it might be enough to deter it. And maybe that's more the point of the law, which is let's put something on the books that's a good idea in theory, and maybe it'll scare people away from doing these types of things. And it might help that one instance or two instances, and if we can save one or two people, then it was worth it.
Right.
I think that's really the only argument that works for me on this because, again, I'll text people who I either know or can assume are on the road, but it's not my responsibility for their actions after they receive that text. It's their responsibility to either choose to make it a dangerous situation where they look at it, make it a little bit safer where they look at it while they're at a stoplight or completely stop in a parking lot or until they get home to their destination. This isn't like hounding, like, you know, I'm not in the car with someone yelling and screaming at them. It's just a text. It's their decision from that point. Sometimes
yeah.
things are important. You want to make sure you get the text message off. You know, like there's times when my girlfriend's driving and I'm like, well, I don't want her to read this text, but I got to make sure I text her this piece of information. I'm on a break at work. I don't want to forget about it. I got to send it now. You know what I mean? So it's an interesting law, and I think it makes for some interesting conversations. And then I think it'll be quite interesting the first time, you know, someone gets convicted of this or even gets charged with it.
Well, the other question is, and I didn't read too much into the article on the legality side to it, but is it going to be criminal charges or would it be civil charges that you could bring against somebody?
I don't know.
That's also an interesting point. Will they get sued? Can that person then get involved in lawsuits? You know, the person who texted their estate, or if they're still alive, if they killed someone, they can get sued, you know. Does that mean the person, if they get convicted or even accused, can that go to, like, a civil suit and they can get
yep.
involved? It's interesting to see how far it could go and how serious the penalty is.
Oh, what about this? What if a daughter who is 12, 13 texts her mother, hey, Mom, I'm going here. Is that okay? And the mom types in, okay, and there's a huge accident. Is that 13-year-old girl going to get sued?
I would think there's got to be some sort of age bracket, just like juveniles. I'm assuming you'd have some sort of legal action against you, but it would be sealed under judicial records for being a juvenile.
But that's just, I don't know. I see where they're going with it. I think being sued might be a little much. I think being fined is probably a better start. You know, if you are texting somebody who's driving and there is an accident, you could be fined $150. You know, like if you litter in an area that says no littering, or if you're littered, there's a charge, or if you're speeding in a work zone, it's like 30 days in jail or $150, whatever the case is. I think it should be more of that, less, you know, being sued.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't know, it's really interesting, you know, because obviously this is something that's in its infancy, and it's hard to tell exactly how it's going to go. And there's always, I mean, I guess that's the case with any law, there's always going to be gray area. And this is a new thing. I mean, texting is relatively new. I mean, I know it's been around longer than you think it has, but as far as the amount of people who are doing it, and, you know, the whole texting and driving campaign is still pretty young as well. You know, so it's going to be growing pains. I'm sure there's going to be people who are going to get charged, and there's going to be an uproar over it for this reason or that. You know, and as I said, I'm still kind of talking through it. You know, I definitely need more information, but I get the heart behind the law and trying to help people out. I don't know how effective it's going to be, and it all depends, too, on what the penalties are and things like that, like you guys have been saying.
Right.
But I think it's a step in the right direction.
I agree.
Even though I'm guilty, you know, even though I'm guilty of texting while driving, and for that matter, doing other stuff on my phone while driving, checking an email, whatever.
Oh.
I try to do it at stoplights, you know, stop signs if it's a, you know, like a four-way stop and there's other cars, obviously, and I've got some time. But yeah, periodically I'll catch myself doing it. You don't even mean to sometimes. You know, it's not like I'm knowingly doing it, but there are times where I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this. And you're just like, oh, well, it's hard because you just, it's one of, just like anything else, you think, why me? Why should I worry? You know, but hey, you know, like the article said, it's in New Jersey. Maybe, you know, they're the first state to have something like this. You know, perhaps they're going to start a trend that'll catch on, and this will be a good way to, you know, at least,
yeah.
You're never going to fix it, just like any other crime or problem. But it might be a good step in that direction.
Right. I'm interested in seeing how this is all going to pan out. I definitely think it's a valid topic. It's definitely something that's worth bringing up. It's definitely worth something that because it needs to be rectified. It needs to be fixed because there are so many people that are out there that do that. And hell, I didn't see, you know, we're going to put phones aside. I was driving home the other day and this lady was reading a book on her steering wheel. What the hell are you doing?
Oh my God.
Well, one, she was in a Buick, so that I stay far away from Buick people as is. But she had a book on the steering wheel and she was reading while she was driving. What was wrong with you? So it's more than just electronic devices.
Oh, absolutely. And but the thing is, you know, those things have probably been going on, like people reading their books. I'm sure that's gone on in the past. It's just that so much more texting while driving is happening, and it's a lot easier to prove, too. If someone gets in an accident while they're reading, you know, they might not be able to put those pieces together because, like, oh, there's a book on the floor. Whereas a phone, they'll see text message records and stuff like that. It's just more prominent. But you're right, and you know, I know it's not going to be banned, and I know it's not the case with everyone, but people talking on the phone, even when they're using a Bluetooth headset, you know, eyes forward, they got both hands on the steering wheel, they drive like morons too. Now, texting, far worse for sure, because they're taking their eyes off the road, they're looking down, they've got at least one hand off the road, or off the steering wheel,
right.
Rather. But even talking, how many times have you been stuck behind someone on, like, say, in the fast lane, and you're like, why is this car going, like, 40 miles per hour? It's 65 here. And they're like, oh, it's probably some old person, you know, some elderly person, and you fly by, and it's someone young or relatively young, and they're just talking on their phone. And they just had no idea how slow they were going. I mean, how many times does that happen?
Yeah.
I don't know. I think those things, you know, people are just dangerous, period, with phones in their hand, whatever they're doing.
Yes, I agree. And it's somewhere I heard that that it's going to be illegal for you to text and walk at the same time, which I think they're going to look at.
I've heard
that. But that's a completely different topic, a completely different subject.
Yeah, that is for sure. That's a tough one.
I want to skip on by because there's a topic that I had with some friends of mine, my next door neighbor and her family. We're at an outdoor restaurant / bar grill place, and we had a 2-hour conversation about this. And I have 2 straight guys, so what better avenue to take than this? Why is it not okay for a guy to approach a girl at a bar? Do you guys have to have an ulterior motive to approach a girl? Can it just be, hey, how are you? Can I buy you a drink? Or, you know, just as harmless as saying, hey, how are you? Or women just being overly sensitive? And once the tables were turned and a girl approached a guy, is that more acceptable than vice versa? Yes or no?
Well, I'll try to hit these quick, and then I'll let Burson go ahead and give his 2 cents. You know, the first question, it almost seems wrong to me at first. Why is it not okay for a guy to approach a girl at a bar? I would argue that it is. But as I think about it, I think the norm is that guys are going to be the ones that eventually, if one sex is going to end up going, and I think that's why your last question asked, you know, what if the tables were turned?
Right.
Normally it is the guy who's going up to the girl and asking to buy her a drink or, you know, maybe eventually asking for a date or a phone number or whatever. So I think it is okay. People understand that that may happen. That's been going on for years and years and will continue to. But you're right. There are a lot of women who are becoming very defensive because they either think the guy has an ulterior motive, which they usually do, which is to get their number, go home with them, whatever. But there are plenty of women who are being defensive, and they should be, because there's I know in Charleston, not a day goes by, or more appropriately, maybe a weekend goes by, where there isn't some story about a guy doing something horrible to a woman. And, you know, maybe it was just someone they picked up at a bar, they met in the street, whatever it may be. You just never know when you're meeting someone just in the bar, you have no background on them, your decision-making is compromised as far as, you know, females concerned. You just never know. So I know that people are getting more defensive, but for the most part, I think it's still it's for the most part acceptable for men to still approach women. That's how some people end up getting dates, whether it's at a bar or somewhere else. That's how a lot of people I know meet. So I think it's still very much acceptable. But, yeah, there is an ulterior motive. I mean, people generally aren't chatting up someone to just be friends. I mean, it certainly happens. Topher, I know you and I, we went to that bar crawl and we were chatting up that couple who, for you and me, we were just chatting up because they were doing something funny and we were just, you know, having a good time with them. I know their motives changed towards you as the conversation went on. But no, it's certainly possible to still meet people and all that good stuff. But as far as the tables were turned, I know when I was single, I would have loved for girls to come up to me. I almost think that's the way it should be because with girls being skeptical of guys, and they should be, again, in a lot of situations, not all, of course,
right.
and guys just being terrible with pickup lines and stuff like that, I think girls are just better at meeting people, and I'm generalizing, I know, but I think they'd be much smoother than guys are. They wouldn't be as overt. Girls would do it the right way, which is, I think that guy's attractive, I'm going to go chat him up, and if it goes somewhere cool, it goes somewhere cool, and if not, maybe we'll be friends. You know, whereas guys are pretty much, got to get in this girl's pants immediately, and they don't care
right.
if she turns out to be ditzy or a bitch or other terrible words I could think of.
Right.
You know, just bad people. They really don't care when they're in the bar. I think it would be better that way, honestly, and that's just me being insecure and lazy and wishing that when I was single, girls would come up to me. So you can be like, all right, this girl is at least a little bit into me because she's talking to me first. It would have been a lot smoother for me.
Right.
Burson, what do you think about that range of topics?
Well, I think when you said that, the very last thing you said was you kind of wish a girl would have come up to talk to you because then that shows that the girl is interested in you. I think the part that we're all missing is that maybe the guy is actually going up to the girl because he's legitimately interested in her. And with the,
exactly.
the females, they may be overly defensive, and rightfully so, because there are some horror stories out there of bar pickups and just not going the way it was planned by any means. And they should be overly defensive, but that's because the bad guys have ruined it for the rest of them. So we can't, as Christian and I, if we were both single, going out to a bar and trying to talk to girls, they're going to be overly defensive because they almost have to be. If they weren't
right.
overly defensive, I would be very, very, very afraid of going home with her. Because if she's not
yeah.
overly defensive, maybe she's going home with everybody.
Right, right. And that brings up a good point also.
Yeah. So is it okay? Why is it not okay for a guy to approach a girl at a bar? Because she's overly defensive. I think that if the tables were turned and a girl approached a guy, Christian is spot on when he says that then it shows that the girl is interested in the guy, which is socially acceptable rather than this creepy guy who's hitting on this girl who doesn't want to have anything to do with him.
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
I think Bertrand was right on.
Yeah, I think that, but you know what? I think that the girl has, if a guy goes up to her and says, hey, how's it going? My name's whatever. A lot of times, you know, do you mind if I buy you a drink? A lot of times girls are like, no, thank you. Or they'll come up with some lame excuse or they'll make a hand gesture to their friend and the friend will pull them away because they have to go to the bathroom for an hour and a half. Or say they have to go to the bathroom and leave, like it happened to a friend of ours, Christian. you know, I think the girl just needs, you know, if take a drink. You're not committed to the person. It's not like when he buys you a drink, you have to marry the guy or go home with him. Take the drink. And, you know, my philosophy is you've got 5 minutes. In 5 minutes, I can determine whether or not you're a skeezed slime ball, you just want what's in my pants, or if you're really interesting, you know, we can continue on this conversation. But a lot of girls become, I hate to use the B word, but a lot of girls end up becoming very bitches.
Standoffish.
Standoffish. I don't like calling it. Very standoffish.
No,
and
you're right.
Immediately shut down. I have nothing to do with you because of, you know, I met this guy at a bar. This guy has good intentions. He really just probably wants to sit down and talk to somebody. I'll buy you a beer. You know, let's watch the game or, you know, let's have a conversation. But I think girls are so, I think women are scorned. And they are now overly sensitive that they feel like they have to always take the defense because they feel like they're being prowled upon.
Well, you know, and that's a commentary on our society and how guys are perceived. And I get it because I have people I know or I've seen guys just be like those types of people that they shouldn't be in bars. And I don't think they're wrong for being defensive. And, again, it's not every girl and it's not every situation, of course.
Right.
But I think the stuff you were kind of poking fun at before about, you know, how many times you've seen a girl be like, no, thank you, or be kind of rude or ask a girlfriend to come save her. I think those are all good ways to just make sure, you know, I think it's cool that girls will go out and kind of have each other's backs and, you know, will make sure that they have it out. And that's the best way to do it. So that way, if a guy does come up, girl's interested, at least enough to take a beer or just chit-chat or whatever, she can do that without having to worry about, okay, what's going to happen next, you know, because unfortunately just the way we are now, you just really don't know. And I think those are, you know, even though it's fun to make fun of and, you know, it's the whole male versus female little quirks that each of us have, I think it's a good thing that they can, you know, have that fall back. And that way they can determine, okay, nope, you know what, I'm talking to this guy and he's not who I thought he was when he was nice and offered me a drink. I'm done here.
Right.
And I almost don't blame some
say,
girls.
Hey, thanks for the drink. Have a great night. You know what I mean? They don't have to
right,
be not committed
right.
to anything. Thank you for the drink.
But you know
what? Meeting you and on your way.
We have a mutual friend, Topher, who is, in person, I don't think you've ever met, but he is notorious for buying girls drinks. And and I say notorious because he does it with such frequency on any given night that he's out. It's just ridiculous how many people he buys drinks for. Sometimes he's just doing it because he wants people to be drinking with him and be having fun and keep the party going kind of situation. But other times he thinks a girl's attractive and he wants to do that. And I've seen both things happen to him where a girl has taken a drink and stayed and hung out, and then whatever happens from there, whether, you know, there was a date or he went home with her or whatever. And I've seen girls
right.
just flat out refuse it and be rude. I've seen some be nice about it, and I've seen some take the drink, have the drink, like, thanks, see ya. And although there's technically nothing wrong with that because he just offered a drink and that's all they're obligated to do is, you know, take that drink.
Right.
It's tough. I've seen him sometimes be, like, bummed out. Like, oh, man, like, she just took that free drink for me, had, like, zero interest in talking to me. And as soon as she got the drink, was, like, off with her friends. And that's pretty lame to do that. But I think you're right. If you accept the drink, you should stay and at least talk for that drink or a portion of it if he turns out to be a real rude person or something. I don't know. There's a lot of different things that go back and forth. But bottom line, you know, it's the whole gender roles thing where the guys are supposed to be the strong ones and the guys who, you know, they make the moves and they go up and show they're interested. They put themselves on the limb so the female doesn't have to. All those old gender roles and stereotypes and stuff. You know, who knows if it was reversed throughout time, then there might, you know, we might be having the exact opposite conversation. But I don't know, an interesting topic, and unfortunately we're running low on time, but I think it's something that we go on and on and on and on and on and on about because there's so many levels to it. But
right.
I think
I
bottom line is, yes, go ahead.
Christian, I know how you met your girlfriend.
Yeah.
Carson, how did you meet your wife?
I met my ex-wife. I met her through college first, and then reconnected after college through work, not at the same location.
Okay. And your
and
current situation, how did you meet her?
Do what?
You are dating somebody, right?
No, I'm not. I'm single, ladies.
Oh, single ladies.
Chris Person is single. See,
you know
what? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Burson's situation, you know, meeting his wife through college, then kind of through work, his ex-wife. You know, my experiences have always been, you know, people I've met through friends or people I've worked with or people I went to school with. It's rare that I pick it rare to, in some situations, hasn't happened at all, where I pick someone up at a bar. There's always a tie-in with friends. I don't think I've ever met someone just completely blind, like went into a bar, didn't have some connection to them, and it turned into more than just harmless flirting at that time. I've never even, you know, gone home with somebody here in Charleston or from any bar ever. You know, college was a little different because it'd be like house parties or dorm parties. But, yeah, I think that's how a lot of people meet people. But there are a lot of folks out there who still do the whole bar dating scene. So I think that question is relevant for a lot of people.
Right. The only, I never picked up anybody at a bar. I mean, I worked at bars for, four or five years. And I met people through there, but it was because I was working there, not because of patrons there.
Right.
Bars are generally terrible places to meet people.
True, but I must be the unicorn because I met Matthew in a bar. I met Matthew at a gay bar.
That's right. That's true.
And I knew nothing about him. Five minutes before he walked in the
door,
I didn't
even know
he existed. You know, and we're going on in January. It'll be 10 years. So I definitely believe that it can happen, provided what you give off, the energy that you give off is positive, and that you're not looking just to hook up. Because I was not at all. I was never one of those people I was never a one night stand type of guy. But you know, I hung out with Matthew for a few hours, and you know, when we closed down the bar, he was like, "So, do you want to go back?" Sure. And I actually hopped in his car and we went over to his place. I met him a couple of hours ago, but his energy was good. I had a good vibe from him. I didn't think I was going to end up in a refrigerator. So, you know, I went home with him. And, you know, it's been 10 years, and, you know, knock on wood, I'm not in a refrigerator yet. So, there you have it.
It could be one of those long, drawn-out plans. It just hasn't come to fruition. No, I'm just kidding.
It could be.
We know Matthew's a great dude, and you guys are definitely lucky to have each other. And, again, we could spin off on that topic, too. Maybe it's different for gay relationships. Maybe the bar scene is more of the scene to do it. I don't know. Just because of percentage-wise, maybe, like, when I was single, when I went out, percentages were in my favor as far as a girl that I saw was probably straight or at least bi, just percentage-wise.
Right.
Whereas if you're gay or you're lesbian, you might be a little different. So sometimes you got to go somewhere where someone is going to be that you know, or at least can safely assume the percentages are in your favor. So who knows? We could go off on that, I'm sure.
We could. And this is probably a good topic for next week. But we are down for our last 30 seconds.
You read my mind.
Thank you guys.
You
so
read
much.
My mind.
Thank you guys so much. I'm a very good mind reader. I may be sick, but I'm a very
you
good mind
are.
Reader. Don't think of me like that.
Stay tuned. Stay tuned for the Guilty Pleasure. It's coming up next. I want to make sure we get that in here. Jake Pentland, Saturday at 4. AMC Press with our good buddy Toku, who we missed out on today. Him and his crew, they're weekdays at 11 p.m. Thank you for listening. You guys have a good night. Topher, Burson, any parting words?
Excellent show as usual. It was awesome. Have a good night, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Are you ready for this one?
Bye-bye.
U-G-R.
Go.
We're saying what we want. Give it to you, not go. Any place, any time. Not afraid to speak our mind. That's just the way we roll. We never gonna go. Unstoppable, original, uncensored radio.
It is, what's today, Thursday, and I am totally excited, as I know Jeffrey is very excited as well, because guess what, folks? We have New York Times best-selling author Steve Alton here with us tonight. I mean, can it get any better than that? It's one day until Friday, and we have a New York Times best-selling author on our show. I'm just almost speechless.
Well, I know anybody that is listening has heard me talk about him. Quite a bit the last couple of weeks, just because, you know, I find the books amazing. They're fast-paced. The amount of research that he puts into these books, you know, you just, I can't put them down. I can't read them fast enough. I mean, I've read every novel he's done so far, and I have really no complaints. They're just that good.
Always a good thing. I mean, you know what, I almost feel like, it's good to hear that, like, there's still good books out there. I mean, not that there aren't good books, but it's almost like books have sort of fallen by the wayside as we get more into this, like, new age of social media and constant contact with Twitter on our phones. And, you know, you can be in the restroom stall and you're on Facebook on your iPhone.
Right.
You know,
and then, like, the whole e-book thing?
I'm not a fan.
I know,
I'm really not.
I know he's, like, working on it, and I'll let him tell about what he's got coming up, and I think it's this month. I have one, and it's just not the same as picking up a book for me. It's just completely different. I have a harder time focusing on it, but I do, I mean, it's for convenience-wise, I mean, it's awesome, but I just, the feel of the book, I don't know, I can't get over it, and I'm just, I can't express the excitement that I have that he's going to be on with us in just a few seconds. Like, it's just amazing. And I feel like a total geek because I'm, like, so excited. You know, for other people, it's like you're a famous celebrity. Ah! You know, and this is somebody that I've read for years that I respect and admire so much. And then to hear his personal journey, it's just been amazing to me. And I can't wait for him to share that with everybody. It's just... it's unreal.
Yeah,
so
I'm actually excited about it. And for you guys listening online as well as over the phone, if you you know, want to share anything, we've got the chat room going. So if you're at the blogtalkradio.com/unscripted, you know, go ahead, scroll down to the chat room. We've got Madison on with us as always tonight. Hey, Maddie, what's up?
Hi.
Oh, there you are.
Hi.
We were looking for you. Hello.
What was that? Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. All right. So are you going to say something other than hi?
All I was going to say is that it's been a long day. It involved troopers, a alternator, and Auburn, New York, and flamingos.
And
flamingos.
You would have read Grim Reaper End of Days, honey, it would have been nothing compared to what you're about to hear.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yes. So, without further ado, let's bring Steve Alton on with us.
Yay!
Can you hear me?
Hello, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Hi, Steve.
Thanks.
Thank you
so
much.
I appreciate the
so excited.
Kind introduction. That was very nice of you.
Well, it's the truth.
I'll certainly try to live up to it.
Well, you've done good so far, and I cannot. I've been on the edge of my seat for like two summers now, waiting for the last book in the Domain series. I'm like, come on, it's got to come. I need it.
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but Phobos won't be the last one. There'll be one more after it. No, I changed my mind and extended the series.
Oh, that just makes me even more excited.
Only because the storyline, asked for it. But Phobos, I think, is my favorite of the three books so far. Just because it's so much fun.
When I first got into it, like, I guess I didn't realize what I was getting into, and I am a very paranoid person about the end of the world, 2012, and aliens. Like, I just get uncomfortable, and when I got, like, you know, partway through it, and I realized what was going on, I was like, I had to stop reading it for a day because I got so nervous. I'm like, I was actually like, this could happen. Like, it was just so real to me. Like, this could really happen.
I really hate to say this to you, but he's also scared of cats, too, so it's not changing much about him.
Well, just
Steve, I got to tell you that when Jeffrey was reading this book, it was like every 5 minutes I was getting a text message, and he's like, oh, my God, I'm so freaked out. You have no idea about this book and the calendar, and it just opened up a Pandora's box that took weeks to calm him down.
Well, Domain was actually written back in 1998, and so it was sort of ahead of the curve with the 2012 stuff, and for that reason, the book sold okay in the United States, but about 7 or 8 years later, it took off in Spain, and became the number one book in Spain, and then it took off in Mexico and Germany and Italy, and now it's having a nice run in the United Kingdom. So I'm very curious and hopeful to see how Phobos does in October.
I have a feeling it's going to do very well. Especially, I mean, the timing couldn't be better for it to come out. I mean, people are starting to get a little nervous.
I think the 2012 movie helped a lot, although it didn't really focus on the Mayan calendar and teach us what that deal was all about. It just sort of tied in into the date and a brief dialogue, and that was that.
Right. I know that was the eye candy started. I thought it was going to go in, and it didn't. I was kind of disappointed. And that just, I mean, especially after reading your books, I was like, come on, give me more. But it's still pretty scary stuff. Do you believe the world's going to end in 2012?
I believe that we're rapidly coming to a fork in the road. And it's going to be sort of a judgment day in some sense. All these natural disasters that are happening, all the things that are going on in the world, everything from peak oil to the overwhelming greed and corruption that's going on in the world. And I was just watching Keith Olbermann, who I love his show, and the Ohio congressman who has steadfastly been pushing to take away the vote from minorities and older people and the like, and was forcing Ohioans to have driver's licenses with them when they voted. Got pulled over for a DUI, didn't have his license, and had a hooker in the car. So, that's the kind of thing that's coming up in 2012. What goes around is going to come around. Yeah.
I agree. Like, I don't know if it necessarily will be the end of the world, but I feel like something's coming. And I mean, just our planet is due for some kind of a switch. Like, I think it's had enough of us abusing it. And the greed, and just, I mean, even in the shell game, the things that you wrote about, I was like, it's something that I guess I didn't think about before. And that book made me stop and think about a lot of things that I guess I just hadn't really put thought into it before. with the government and oil, and it just kind of stopped me in my tracks. It made me think, like, yeah, something's seriously wrong.
Well, not all the books, but a lot of the books try to take on reality and open your eyes to things that are actually happening out there, and tell it in the form of a fictional story that,
right,
you know, can have a greater impact than just a documentary or a nonfiction book.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's, I think, what has made me so attached to your books is that you take fiction and you bend it with the truth so much that it almost becomes hard to separate the fact from the fiction. Which
I'm curious,
is
Steve,
just,
what... Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Madison.
I just wanted to know, like, I mean, obviously with writing these books and even hearing Jeffrey, you know, react to it, and obviously dealing with the extreme nature or even happening of basically karma catching up with us in 2012, what do you think is the craziest reaction you've gotten from maybe one of your readers or one of your fans to what you've written? You know, what was the craziest response that you got because of one of your books?
Crazy response. I think I had an email from a woman who decided that she was the reincarnation of Lilith, who was one of the characters in the books. And, you know, I said that, you know, I tried to talk her down and said, that's not who you are. You're not a succubus and you're not this evil creature. You're, you know, so let's get off of that.
And that character is definitely evil. Like,
but she changes in Phobos.
She scares me a little bit.
Well, she's scary in Resurrection, but things have come around in Phobos, and it's an interesting plot line because you may actually like her in an evil sort of way.
I mean, I know, like, with the, you have the newsletter that you send out monthly, which I have, like, 3 different emails, and each one of them get it, so whichever one I've checked first at the beginning of the month, I have the update. And when you sent out and you gave, you know, your fans the preview, I was like, we got to, like, the last page in the preview, and I'm like, no! I mean, to see what that character went through as a child and what she was kind of able to accomplish, I guess, was kind of a big thing. I mean, obviously, you know, she's kind of superhuman, but it was amazing to me that the character evolved into what she did. And she had the plan.
Well, you've only seen the beginning of the iceberg, so.
I can't wait.
Yeah, that's a fun story. And scary, because there is a threat out there that could take us down in 2012, and you know, it's a crazy situation. It's driven by the ego of scientists who are hunting the Pulitzers, or not the Pulitzer, but the Nobel Prize, and you know, they basically built this machine in Geneva underground that collides protons at near light speed, and in an attempt to recreate the Big Bang. And it's an insane prospect, because in the process of doing so, they're creating miniature black holes. And one type of this black hole is called a stranglet. And a stranglet has the ability to escape the chamber and grow larger. And so why are they doing this? Well, they're doing it because they're in search of something called the boson-Higgs element, which is nicknamed the God particle, and it's ironic that they should name something the God particle when they're trying to act like God. And, you know, if there's anything that we've learned about atoms, is that you don't split them and you don't smash them together, because nothing good can happen from those two processes.
How about just not try to play God? Like, that in itself is just scary enough.
Yeah, I mean, there's no information that they're going to gain from that that's going to you know, lead us down the journey of Star Trek or Voyage to the Stars or anything like that. It's just, you know, they're just theoretical, you know, quantum physics, and it's no good can happen from it.
It's like little boys drinking Pop Rocks and eating Pop Rocks and drinking soda. They're doing an experiment just to really see what happens. And I think they're messing with things that they don't really know what they're getting into.
Well, it's one thing to mess with yourself, and it's another thing to create a situation where the entire planet can get sucked into a black hole that you've created. And, you know, that's unfortunately a possibility. And that's the threat in Phobos.
Well, and I love how in the book you have, like, the timeline of how it's just this, like, almost continuous loop. Like, I thought that was a very neat concept, and it kind of actually made me feel a little better when I got to that part, because I'm like, well, okay, if it ends in 2012, we'll just start over and see what happens this time.
Like, yeah, I not this time around. Around.
Yeah, we're totally into it a little better. Like, it was just, I don't know, I couldn't put it down. And even in Grim Reaper, how really, I mean, it was like the end of days, but by our own hand. That, I mean, I'm not even sure. Like, and at first, honestly, I read the you know, the blurb about it, and then I pre-ordered it, and it was great because it came out right up, like, by my birthday. So I was like, woohoo, happy birthday. But I was like, I don't know, like, Grim Reaper? Like, what's this going to be about? And then I read it, and it was another one I couldn't put down on it. It amazes me how you've been able to tie in what I didn't know how you were going to do it. And it ended up being this amazing book that I was like, again, like, this is stuff that we need to really be careful with what we're messing with.
Well,
biological issues,
you know, for your listeners, the basic story behind Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper is a very layered story, is that a biochemical scientist who works at Fort Detrick introduces a man-made version of the bubonic plague at the UN. Believing that she's the tool to introduce revelations to the world. And, you know, she's a little bit psychotic, but these biowarfare weapons are actually being made as we speak at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and Battelle Labs in Ohio. And, you know, it's scary stuff. And, you know, there's something in the Bible that basically states that when negativity, you know, the scales of justice are, you know, pulled toward negativity and darkness, that the angel of death will walk the earth. And there's been several times in the history of mankind that the angel of death has walked the earth. The first time, you know, depending upon what you take out of it, is the story of Noah, when Noah built an ark not to carry animals but to keep the angel of death out. Because civilization at that point had grown so negative, and so much corruption and so much greed and negativity and hatred in the world, that God said, okay, enough's enough. You build yourself an ark to keep the angel of death out, because that's it. The second time, which is a little bit scarier, happened in 1346, when bubonic plague raced out of Asia and crossed into Europe and Africa. And was so devastating that it wiped out 60% of the entire world's population. And this was at a time, you know, in 1346 that, you know, people got around on a horseback or you know, they did have ships, sailing ships, but, you know, the vector was the flea, and the flea bit the rat, and the rat passed on bubonic plague to humans. What's scary is that between 2012, which is the Mayan's doomsday, and 1346, which is when bubonic plague started, the amount of years difference is 666.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's the next time that the Grim Reaper is supposed to make its appearance.
And that's what I love, that you've incorporated all of these, you know, facts and I mean, you know, some people may call them myths, whatever, into the books, and it's just, I just can't say enough how it just captivates you and keeps you like, oh, wow, you know, like, it's just, it's amazing, and in Grim Reaper, it's just, with, I mean, when we had Anthrax, like, I kept thinking about that, and like, this is dangerous stuff. We should not be messing with things that we can't fix. And I mean, I don't really want to give away the book, but what happened, you know, it got loose in New York, and what were they going to do? There was no way to control it. But to kind of eradicate the whole city. I mean, and that's something that could be a very realistic thing in the near future if we let it go on. It was very frightening. But, and I found, I loved the, your author's note, just, I mean, it moved me when I read it, to find out what had happened to you. Can you share with everybody what happened to you on May 5th in 2009 with your wife?
Well, it was during the writing of Grim Reaper, and Grim Reaper's a book about good and evil, and, you know, cause and effect, and on that night, my wife had gone to a vitamin shop around the neighborhood, and while she was in there, two armed men in masks came in with guns and robbed the place, and basically took her and a clerk and duct taped them to the floor and bound them and gagged them and put a gun to their head, and you know, that could have been it. And you know, it's a scary situation, and in the author's note, you know, I basically state that, you know, I had been introduced to Kabbalah, which is a study of spirituality and sort of the science of spirituality that is 4,000 years old and comes from the Book of Formation, which was written by Abraham, the patriarch, and, you know, had something horrible happen to my wife. Had she not survived, I don't know what I would have done. And it sort of put me in the same shoes as my lead character who had a family situation as well.
It definitely, I mean, I read that and I just, my heart stopped for you because I couldn't imagine. And just the fact that you were writing this book about good and evil and something like that happens. And I mean, and just to go through that, I mean, with your wife, I can't even imagine how hard that must have been after for her. Just, I'm sure that she had tons of emotions that just,
she did.
I wouldn't know how to go back out to the store.
Well, what helped her is that her Kabbalah teacher explained to her that, you know, it's possible that her presence there, you know, kept people from getting hurt. That, you know, her belief in you know, the Creator's light and kept her safe and kept them safe. So that gave her something that she could live with. And so that helped.
I mean, that's amazing. I love in here you say, but who knows, perhaps one day the man who held a gun to my soulmate's head will pick up this novel and garner the spiritual tools he needs to transform his own life. So from that, I'm assuming he wasn't caught.
No, he wasn't caught. And, you know, the premise behind that is that from the greatest darkness has the potential for the greatest light. And so, you know, even someone who has done horrible things can transform their behavior and contribute to society in a positive way and, you know, bring light to the world.
And I thought, you know, that was so, I mean, honorable of you to put that in there, and I just thought, how amazing would it be if that person does read the book someday, finds out that it was your wife, and reads that, and maybe it will change his life, and hopefully for the better. I mean, it's just, it's unreal that these things happen, and it just, and the way that it happened, and I feel bad because also you've lost your father recently.
Yeah, it's been rough.
And then 2007, right? You were diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Yeah.
And how, and I know that's definitely done affected in your life, as you shared with us in the newsletters. Can you, how has it changed your life, I guess?
Well, you know, everybody has challenges, and I certainly have mine. And there are, you know, from my perspective, there are people who have it a lot worse than I do.
Right.
So, you know, I consider myself lucky for the problems that I have. How does Parkinson's affect me? Well, it affects the right side of my body. Sometimes it's noticeable, sometimes it's not. It's something that causes rigidity, so that it feels like, you know, at times there's, you know, lead flowing through the blood in my wrist or my forearm. And it can get a little uncomfortable at times, but, you know, my choice of combating it is not to go on drugs.
Wow.
Because the drugs can cause the same symptoms as Parkinson's. Michael J. Fox went on the drugs in an attempt to continue his acting career, and they put him on heavy drugs right away, and, you know, the heavy drugs are dopamine, because Parkinson's is a lack of dopamine, which helps you control the muscular impulses and nerve impulses. So they put you on dopamine, and then your body gets used to it, and you have to go on more dopamine and more dopamine, and I just didn't want to do that. So I take a half a pill, which is an Azelect, which is a drug that's not dopamine, which doesn't affect me, but it said that it could push the symptoms away for some years so that it doesn't worsen. But I've also had a stem cell treatment that is sort of a breakthrough going on here in Boynton Beach, Florida, where there's a doctor who has discovered that by releasing your body's own stem cells in large quantities for on and off periods, the stem cells, you know, are sort of like a universal healer going through your own body and can help restore some of the stolen effects of Parkinson's. So I had that done last summer. I hope to have it done again, because it definitely did help.
Wow. Is it something that you're going to have to, like, continue to get yearly?
No, I don't think so. I think for the people that I've met who have Parkinson's, who underwent the treatment, their results were a little bit better than mine was, because their symptoms were a lot worse.
Right.
It's also possible that I've discovered that I had high levels of metal in my body, mercury and lead, which has been taken out through chelation process. And I think that the stem cell treatment would have probably worked better if I had had that done first. But I didn't know.
Right. Isn't that really dangerous to have that removed? I was just reading about that the other night.
It's not dangerous to have it removed. It's the process of removing it is actually simple, but you can pick things up in the environment, or, I mean, even certain types of shampoos have metals in them, or you know, you never know what you're going to. I mean, I'm pretty careful about the things that I eat, but you never know what it's from. So, you know, and we don't live in an area that has high pollution, air pollution, and we drink water that's purified through reverse osmosis. So, but you just never know what's in your body. And I think those things can contribute to disease.
Right. Well, I mean, it amazes me. I mean, even just looking at Michael J. Fox, to see, I mean, 10 years ago to where he is now, I mean, it's very heartbreaking. And I mean, from looking at it from my perspective, from growing up with him, I mean, it seemed, even though he had it for so long, it seemed to me like it happened very rapidly once, like, he was on Spin City and he had to leave. Like, so, I mean, to me, like, that was very scary. And when I first, you know, read that you had it, I was like, how is this guy going to continue to write?
Well, people get it in varying degrees, and he's sort of the poster child for Parkinson's, along with Muhammad Ali. But you know, my symptoms are nowhere near like that. I mean, you can see me and I can just be sitting there and you wouldn't know that I had Parkinson's. Usually I don't have too many tremors. Sometimes I have no tremors at all. So exercise is a big thing that helps Parkinson's, and I've always been an exercise demon, and I've always taken care of myself that way. And so I find that when I work out, you know, the Parkinson's symptoms lessen. So I work out. So it's sort of a motivating factor to get my ass to the gym at 11 o'clock at night if I haven't gone. And then I, you know, I'm fortunate in the gym and that I work out. It stays late, stays open late, so it accommodates my schedule.
I can't imagine. I mean, how is the writing process? Do you bury yourself in a room for days on end when you get into a writing mode? Like, how do you have time for your family in the gym? And I mean, just dealing with the doctor.
Well, you know, it's, you know, I work out of my house and I have an office upstairs, and you know, every day is a little bit different. You know, I'm working on a new project right now, a new novel called The Omega Project, but, you know, I started my day and checked my email, and my agent had emailed me, and he said he sold the rights to Goliath to Spain. And
for a movie?
No, for novel, the novel rights. And Goliath is a book that was written in probably 99, actually I think it was 2001. I think I finished it right after the September 11th. So, you know, a lot of things have changed in Goliath, the story of Goliath, because, you know, it deals with a submarine that basically goes after the guy who hijacks the sub. Uses it as a tool to fight dictatorships and authoritarian governments, and the computer that's in charge of the ship has a mind of its own and is learning from the bad guys. So, but in the original book, Iraq was nuked, and Saddam was still around, and since then, obviously, things have changed, so I need to go back before we send it to Spain and swap out a couple nations here and there, and it means me going through the whole book. So instead of writing the Omega Project today, I've spent the days on Goliath. So every day is a little bit different, and you have to sort of adjust your schedule based upon the needs of publishers and or movie deals or whatever it might be, and you know, that can take a while.
And now, are we going to be getting a sequel in America to Goliath anytime soon?
Well, the storyline of the Omega Project is actually what was originally Sorceress, and it was just such a great storyline that everyone who heard it said, you know, you got to let it stand on its own. So I sort of put Sorceress on the back end and back burner, and started working on Omega.
I mean, I am definitely a person when I've read the books like Goliath, it's just one of those books like one is not enough. There's just so, I'm like, I know there's more of a story, especially the way it was ended, which is kind of like, I'll be back. And it's just like, yeah. And now, am I crazy, or was there a little tie-in with the submarine in one of your other books?
Well, I had used the name Goliath in The Trench for this big oil tanker that had been converted to a fusion reactor. And when the storyline for Goliath came out, I wanted to use the name. So it's not really much of a tie-in. They share the same name, but, you know, a little different.
Oh, I thought there was something with the one of the guys maybe from MAG that had actually created the submarine. I could have just connected it all in my own head, though.
I think you may have.
It happens. I'm just, like, always looking. I don't know. But I just, that was another one that I couldn't put down. I think I had read it in less than a day. It was just, it's an amazing book. And then, of course, what got me started, I did a cross-reference because I had a very, very hard time reading as a child. And it stuck with me to adulthood where maybe I'd read a book a year. And then I picked up this one book when I was nannying. I couldn't put it down. And then that was it. So I did a cross-reference, and your name came up for Meg. And I loved Jaws as a child. Loved it. I remember when the movies were on USA, we'd tape them on our, you know, VHS player and watch them. So when I was like, oh, a shark book? I'm like, this, I ran to the library and I got the book. It was another one I couldn't put down. And I was just so captivated. I'm like, it makes Jaws look like a goldfish. I mean, how did you come up with that concept?
For Meg?
Yeah.
I also liked Jaws when I was growing up. And in addition to reading Jaws, I read, a lot of great white shark attack stories that really happened. And there was always a little blurb about Carcharodon megalodon, the prehistoric cousin of the great white, but there was never anything commercially written about it. And when I was 35 and juggling my career a little bit, I picked up a Time magazine, and on the front page, on the cover, was the Mariana Trench, which is the deepest part of the planet, 7 miles down this 1,500-mile-long gorge. And as I read it, as I read the article, and I read about hydrothermal vents and the different sort of species in the abyss, I recall the little blurb about megalodon, and immediately went to the library because there was no internet back then in 95 and all the way back then, and I searched the shark books until I found the picture, and I set a goal that I was going to write this book, and I was going to take 30 days to research it as much as I could, and then I'd start writing it, and because I had a job, what I call a J-O-B, just over broke, the only time I could work on the book was at 10 o'clock at night till 3 in the morning and on weekends, and so I set up shop in my living room table and with a dining room table, and which kind of pissed my wife off a little bit, and I said, this is what I want to do. So I basically by writing 2 to 3 pages a night, I was able to finish it in about 6 months and start to search for an agent. And, Meg was actually my first book and the biggest deal that I've gotten on a book deal.
And
a roller coaster ever since.
Was that your first time that you decided you want to write with this book? Because I know before it said that you had a general manager's job at a wholesale meat plant.
Well,
how do you go from that to writing?
I had gone to school as a physical education major, and I actually wanted to coach basketball. And I went through 10 straight years of college to get a doctorate degree to have something to fall back on. And my last year of writing a dissertation, I happened upon a job selling water treatment equipment, whole house water treatment equipment, and turned out to be pretty good at it, and to the point that they offered me to open a factory distributorship in Wilmington, Delaware, and I did that for a while, and things went into a little bit of a roller coaster there and ended up moving to Florida and opened up a smaller company and teetered with that a little bit and then bounced around on a couple different jobs. From the water treatment company, I had set things up that I was working for myself essentially because the overhead was just too high. And one day I got this weird call from a guy who said, is this Steve Alton? I said, yeah. And he said, I could have been your father. And I just sort of wondered what kind of genetic mishap I had been involved in. And turns out that the guy used to date my mother when she was 17 years old. And for some reason, he decided to check up on me. And he invited me to his company to meet him. And it turns out he owned this wholesale meat company. And 2 hours later, I had talked myself into a job as a sales manager and got out of the water industry and was working for him. And he promoted me to general manager in 6 months. And things were going so well that the the board of directors made up of his stepsons decided that they didn't need me anymore. So on Friday the 13th, on September 1996, I lost my job. And 4 days later, Meg was auctioned to the six biggest publishing houses in New York and garnered this huge deal.
I mean, that's what dreams are made of right there. I can't imagine a better story.
Well, you know, there's more to the story. You know, Meg had been optioned. We had gotten an option from Hollywood Pictures before the book went on auction, and that's what pushed up the deal. But it was part of a two-book deal. And the second part of the book deal was this Mayan calendar story, which at the time was called Fathom. And when I went to write the book, I wanted to tell the story of the Mayan calendar, and the publishing house, Bantam Doubleday, which did Jaws 25 years earlier, all they wanted was an underwater story. And Domain is not an underwater story. I mean, there's elements of it that are underwater, right, but it's the calendar story. And rather than make a fuss because so much money was at stake, I just wrote the book that they wanted me to write, and it wasn't very good. And 2 weeks before I was supposed to get paid $1 million, if you can believe that, they canceled the book. And, you know, that was, you know, like a pretty bad punch in the gut. And I had just moved in, my family and I had just moved into a brand new house from an apartment, and I knew I was going to lose the house, and I had just gotten a brand new car, and I knew I was going to lose the car, and all the little toys that I bought on the first deal, I knew I was going to lose, because I owed taxes to the government and was planning on paying those things with the book deal. But we settled. I had to sue them, and we settled out of court, and so that I could get the rights back to the book. And I took some time off because I had spent 2 years with it, and wrote Trench, which was sold to a second publisher. And by that time, I'd gotten the rights back to the book that would eventually become Domain, and sold that. So, you know, I was able to write the ship. But you know, it definitely Bantam Doubleday. In order to save face, because Meg had been such a big bestseller, you know, that they had to justify firing the author. but what had happened was, it wasn't the book that they fired me for. It was the fact that Doubleday had been purchased by Bertelsmann, which is this huge German conglomerate, and the outgoing president, Arlene Friedman, was trying to make her bottom line look better to keep her job. So anyone who had been given a high advance in the beginning, they, by dropping their contracts, they could save the advance, and that would have made her books look better. And so myself and a few other authors were caught up in that mess, and you know, it's not very good.
I can't imagine. That's tough. I mean, that, to have all of that, like, handed and then pretty much taken away, that is just,
well, you know, I could say it now, I couldn't say it at the time, but, you know, there was the positive in the negative, you know, the silver lining was that it forced me to become a better author. It forced me to be more concerned with my character development and elements of the story and the writing. Because Meg had done really well because everybody loves reading about a 70-foot great white shark, but, you know, at some point you have to develop into becoming a better writer, and this was the impetus that forced me to become a better writer and learn my craft, and my books are far better now. Every book is a little bit better. I mean, I spent the day working on Goliath. Goliath was the fourth book that I wrote, and, you know, Omega is the 12th, and between the fourth and the 12th, I've become a better writer. So as I'm reading the passages, I'm changing them now because I don't like, you know, some of the wording, and I want to make it a little bit better.
And I mean,
but you can drive yourself crazy doing that. And not, you know, writing, you know, and editing, and you can edit yourself into a corner.
God bless you, because I mean, Mike can attest to this. And I'm sure you can probably even acknowledge it, because when I send an email, like, my grammar is horrible. I would have loved to have been a writer, but I have no imagination. I can write a blog, but I can't write. So to see, like, it just amazes me that the stories that, I mean, you've come up with, like, I don't think I could ever be that creative. And it's just the way, I mean, it's captivating because I didn't think it was just a shark book. Like, there was, like, science involved with, you know, the trench and the submarines. I thought it was better than Jaws. There was more to the story and more science.
Well, from my major criticism of Jaws, I mean, how do you criticize Peter Benchley and 10 million books sold? But
right.
And he certainly was an amazing writer. But the one thing that, if for me as a 15-year-old reading Jaws, was that I wanted more shark.
Right.
I mean, any chapter that was about the shark was cool, but it was like it was a tease. And then we had to listen to Brody and him, you know, and or Hooper urinating in Ellen Brody's bathroom or whatever it might be. And, you know, that's all fine, but, you know, let's get back to the shark. So
yeah,
when
I
wrote Meg, you know, I made sure that there was a lot of shark in the book. And when I wrote Hell's Aquarium, you know, I have dueling stories going on between one shark story and the other shark story. So, you know, you get plenty of action.
That was exciting, especially because we learned what other creatures are in the trench. I was like, oh, we could go lots of places with this. Is there possibly any spin-offs coming?
Not a spin-off. There'll be one more book in the Meg series, Night Stalkers, but I won't even start that until the Meg movie moves into production.
Yeah. Oh, that is a great thing, which I also wanted to cover, because I keep seeing it's going into production, it's in development hell, it's a possibility. What is the latest update on the Meg movie?
Well, you know, just as a backstory, Meg was option before my first book deal, and Hollywood Pictures bought it, which is part of Disney, and they went through two lousy scripts, you know, the rights were reverted when the president of Hollywood Pictures, David Vogel, was fired. So the rights came back to me, and nothing happened for a while, and then through my friend Nick Nunziata, who's the founder of Chud, we got the book to Guillermo del Toro and Lloyd Levin and Larry Gordon, and they loved it, and they took my script that I had written at the time, and then Jan de Bont was added to the mix, who was the director of Twister, and Jan had his own take on the story, and so we worked on a script together, and we sent it to New Line, and New Line optioned it, but New Line wanted to work with Shane Salerno, who wanted to work with Meg, so Shane Salerno rewrote the book as a script, unfortunately, Shane went, you know, way out in left field.
Wasn't there something about a flying shark or something somewhere?
No, the flying shark script came from Hollywood Pictures.
Okay.
Shane's contribution was to make the shark growl, to which I said that if you don't remove the growl, I'm going to go postal on all of you and kill you.
yeah. Wasn't it growling in Jaws 4?
Yeah, something like
shark
that. Made. No.
Yeah, and it was, like, insane. Like, what the hell is the shark doing?
But Shane basically wrote Moby Dick with a shark, and to New Line's credit, they didn't like it. But the rights reverted again, and then I had a friendship with producer Belle Avery, who's not a big-time producer, but what she's good at is sourcing money. And she got a lot of contacts, and she basically said, well, let's shed all the, you know, the garbage that's attached to this book and go write a new script and, you know, stay on the novel. And I did, and we worked on the script together, and it's a great script. In fact, we showed my script and Shane Salerno's script to 25 people and took our names off of it, and all 25 overwhelmingly voted for my script. And
nice.
Couldn't wait to see the movie. So with that script, we went out and got financing, and we have the some bigwigs over in China are going to finance it for $150 million, and they're at the point now where they're just finalizing the paperwork. You know, it'll be an American movie and with American director or maybe a Chinese director, I don't know. But, you know, it'll be first class all the way, and the script's good. So,
well,
you know, the most important thing about
a fat dude that they need to kill in the first 10 minutes, tell them to call me. I would just love, like, when you did the contest, I was like, I want to be a dead body. But I cannot wait. I think this movie will be huge. I believe it to be huge.
And personally,
I think it will, too. I mean, I think it's going to be the number one grossing movie of all time for its time, for its period. But
I agree.
If it's done right, and I think that it will be done right, and it starts with a good script and good characters and good storyline, and you can't depend upon the special effects. If you have a good story, then the special effects just aid the story.
Right. Well, I think, too, because you wrote the book, the script needs to come from you. Like, I don't want to see somebody else's script on the movie screen. I read the book. I want to see how you would translate the book into a movie, not somebody else. And I think that's where books and I can't stand it. I cannot read a book and watch a movie. It just doesn't work for me because the book always blows away the movie.
And there's a reason for that, and that's because two reasons. One is because the author sweats the details and gets the story right, whereas a screenwriter doesn't have the time to investigate, do the research on a story, so they come up with the first thing they come up with. And the second reason is because the WGA, the Writers Guild, sets up a rule which deals with subsidiary rights and royalties and things like that, and that is that if you want credit for the script, you have to have changed at least 30% of the original material. So they automatically build in change from the original source material. So for something like Meg, which has undergone several scripts, everyone who takes it it's sort of whispered down the lane. The original message is so blurred by the time it gets back to you because everyone's changing it. Whereas for me, the author, I don't care about the credit because I wrote the novel. I just want the best. I just want the best script. I just want the best storyline.
And there has not been a shark movie. Yeah, I mean, there was that one, like 10 years ago, other than Jaws, really.
The funny thing about Deep Blue Sea is that when Meg was originally optioned, the agent in charge of the option worked for ICM, Jeff Robinoff. And he and David Vogel, the head of Hollywood Pictures, did not like each other. But he optioned him Meg, and while Meg was in development, Robinoff became the head of Warner Brothers. And so he greenlit Deep Blue Sea to try to attack David Vogel. Not because it was. So, and ironically, Deep Blue Sea was the picture that got made and not Meg.
I mean, and even for me, like, I watched that movie, I can't even count how many times, just because I was so desperate for a shark movie.
Well, I think there is a 3D shark movie coming out this summer, which looks really stupid, but
They had anything with the water, I'm obsessed with, and I'm mortified of the ocean, but I just love it. Like, they had that Piranha movie, and I was like, okay. Yeah, not so much. So I have been, like, waiting. So I'm hoping and praying that this movie comes out soon. And it would have been great if it comes out before the end of the world. I'm not going to be happy if I have to go and don't get to see Meg on the big screen, okay?
You and me both.
Well, we have just a few minutes left, and I know you have some exciting news about an e-book that's coming out, right, relatively soon?
Yeah, I mean, it should be in July. What happened was I think Meg was the only book that possibly the Trench 2 that didn't come out as an e-book. And with publishers, the publisher who options the book, gets all the ebook rights. But Meg has been through some weird situations. It was originally, you know, printed by Bantam Doubleday, and then when we knew New Line Cinema was buying the rights to the book, my friend purchased the rights back because he had a publishing company, and so Tsunami Books published it for a couple of years. And then Tsunami Books went out of business, and I had to buy the rights back to Meg, and the problem was that the book went out of print. And the Adopt an Author program, which is the program I founded that helps high school reluctant readers, had 10,000 teachers, you know, and, you know, the 5,000 active ones were using the book. And so they had run out of books for their classroom, so I had to get the book back into print immediately. So I optioned it to the movie producer, and she had the book printed up and for the teachers. But she had never done the ebook. So we have a company that just does ebooks is going to do Meg, and they said, well, you know, as sort of a free giveaway or a 99-cent giveaway, can you write a prequel? And I said, well, actually, Meg lends itself to a prequel because the story deals with what happened to Jonas Taylor 7 years ago, but never really delves into it too much. So the Meg prequel is what happened 7 years ago. It's the entire story. But it's only, you know, maybe an 85-page book. And
well, it's 85 pages I'm looking forward to.
It's
so
fun.
I cannot wait.
For people who like Meg, there's like little things in the book that they'll be like, oh, man, that's cool because I know what happens to him or I know what happens to her. And, I don't know if it's not going to be printed. It'll just be an e-book because it's a giveaway. And I have to think of a way to get it to readers who don't have, you know, Kindles or, you know, whatever.
Well, I just got the first e-book, and I'm telling you, I'm not loving it so far. There's just nothing the same as a book.
There's
but.
Nothing like a real, you know, I'm not an e-book fan. I prefer to hold a book and turn the pages mm-hmm. myself. And
I like seeing it on my shelf after I've done reading it, and then I go back, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. It's just something about the physical, the smell, the touching, the turning of the page. Like, I just love it. The e-book thing, but I'm telling you, I'm on this. The prequel, I cannot wait. Do you have an exact date of when it's coming out?
Not yet. I just did the final edit on it a day before the newsletter came out. So they're reading it now, and once they give the thumbs up, they'll give me a date. I'm guessing towards the end of the month. But if you check on Amazon, you know, once they announce it, it'll be announced.
Well, Steve, I cannot thank you enough for coming on. I mean, I could probably spend a week just talking to you about the books, and I'm really upset that I didn't get enough time to talk about Adopt the Author program that you started, so I'm hoping that you will come on with us again, and we can talk about that more. And I'm hoping you'll come on again, too, the next time your books are coming out, because I just can't get enough. And I just want, you know, all of my friends, I've promoted them on Facebook, I've told everybody they've got to read them, and I'm just honored that you came on with us. So anytime you want to come on, you've got something going on, please let us know, and you are more than welcome. And I definitely would like to do more with Adopt an Author, because I think it's a great thing that you did for a lot of kids.
Well, I appreciate that, and, you know, we'll stay in touch, and I'll come on again.
Yeah, well, and that's one of the great things about you, I have to say, is I have emailed you numerous times throughout my different emails, and I'm like, God, this guy's got to be, yeah, I've got to be driving him crazy. You have emailed me back every time I've had a question about a book or anything, and I really appreciate that, and I think that's what makes you such a great author. You know, to do that for your fans, that's just amazing.
Well, without my fans, I don't have a career, so.
Well, I want to thank you again, Steve, for coming on, and I will definitely be emailing you so we can hopefully get something set up with Adopt an Author, and maybe get some people that are involved in it as well with you. I want to thank you for coming on. We've got about 30 seconds left, everybody. I want to thank everybody that's listening. I can't thank Steve enough. I can't believe it's over. I'm kind of disappointed. But we will see you all tomorrow and make sure you visit our website to get the link to Steve's site and get his books, guys. You're going to love them. You will not be able to put them down. We will see you tomorrow. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
This has been a presentation of Unscripted Radio.